Well, 5 weeks have gone by this evening. Hello, good evening. My name's David Jay, and welcome to the September edition, 1 week later than you might have expected, of our cricket chat show On the Front Foot. Tim Bowling and I are going to have a little natter for the first half hour. We've got three extremely interesting guests from Lye, just down the road, from Godalming in the west of the county, and from Mogadore Wanderers, because apart from Godalming, we're going to be concentrating on friendly cricket tonight. Tim and I are now going to attempt to do something different from our usual formulae good evening. So, Tim, let's just stick with the fact that you got here safe and sound.
Yes, I got here fine tonight, David. Good evening.
And we've both, since you've been back, had a cricketing day out, or in my case, an evening out. How did you go on at the Oval last week?
Yeah, it was good fun. I'd only come back from Italy on Thursday night, and I was at the Oval on Saturday during the day. And for the first time ever, I actually had front row seats in the OCS stand at the bottom front row, which was good, but it was interesting seeing it from that angle. Initially, the players were sort of blending in with the crowd, so it was a bit difficult sometimes to see all of the action from that angle.
I think you appreciate more the way in which it can be hard for fielders to pick up the ball.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
And also for batsmen, when in places like Trent Bridge and Lords, you've still got a mixture of pavilion spectators and a sort of a sight screen.
Yes, well, that's right, yeah. It was weird, because I expected it to be like watching a club game when you're on ground level and you see everything and it's quite nice. But I think it probably would have been a bit better being about 10 rows back, I think. But it was a great day. We had a good day, good fun.
My friend Ian Baker, who's been on this show, you didn't meet him because you were on holiday a couple of years back when Ian came on with Phil Mann. But Ian's an MCC member and he's so quick off the mark that unless you stop him, we always get front row seats in the grandstand at Lord's. And I don't like being right down there.
No.
I like to, as you just said, 10 or 11 rows up.
Yeah, you get a proper view then.
And a completely different perspective. And how did you feel about your day's cricket?
It was good fun. I mean, it's always a good day out of the cricket. A good test match. There were four of us there. I thought the actual cricket itself wasn't the most exciting day's play I've ever seen. But then when you go to see a test match, as long as the weather holds, which it did, it's always good fun.
Well, it's been old-fashioned test cricket. I mean, I'm sure whether with our guests or later on in this half hour, we'll talk a bit about the England-India series and how it all played out. But there was an astonishing difference to me. Talk about being at the Oval. Think back to 76, which was the other very long, very hot summer, when the Oval was totally parched because there was a hosepipe ban and Holding ran in and took his umpteen and won wickets, and it was Greg who grovelled, not the side from the Caribbean. But this time, and not just at the Oval, they've had enough water to keep the cricket grounds green. I wonder if a factor has actually been some of that water on the outfields evaporating in the hot sunshine and causing a bit more swing.
Because it could well be. I mean, it was amazing. You're right. It's amazing how green the pitches are, or certainly the Oval was, given the weather we've had. I mean, my lawn has turned a lot greener in the last couple of weeks, but they've kept that really well, considering.
It's swung to a quite extraordinary extent, yeah, right through the series, and no coincidence that when it stopped swinging, opening batsmen started scoring hundreds.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, isn't it? It's probably the first series for some time where the ball has held precedent over the bat, which is, I mean, I'm a wicketkeeper batsman, but it's quite nice to see the bowlers actually performing and having sort of the whip hand, as it were, over the batsman.
Well, as I said to you, I mean, thinking back to the one dayers against Australia, I mean, 480 odd. I want to see a contest,
yeah, exactly.
not 10 and over.
That's, well, I think also you're quite right with the ball swinging the way it did. It suited our bowlers. I think, I mean, we'll talk about the series later, but I think 4-1 was reasonably flattering for England. I think a 3-2 would have been perhaps a more fairer result, I think. I think 4-1 did flatter us a little bit.
If Virat Kohli had won a couple of tosses, it could have been 4-1 the other way.
I don't think they won a single toss, did they?
No, they didn't. And I think that, you know, like it or lump it, and a few runs at the end and the fairy tale ending and all of that, which we'll no doubt talk about later on, I think as well that we're in a situation where the ball dominated in any case, but two deeply flawed batting sides.
Yes, oh, definitely, definitely. Very, very weak batting sides on both sides. I mean, all right, Kohli did well for India. People were questioning his ability to play in England. I think he probably answered those critics. But again, even for Kohli, for when he got that amazing 100, he was dropped by Milan, wasn't he? And that could have completely changed that. You know, it's been fortunate. The batsmen have generally been pretty weak, and certainly so in the England side. And that's why I think 4-1 was a flattering score.
I'm absolutely sure of that. And I thought, without going on for the moment, how about England versus India? It was inevitable we were going to drift into this. But I thought Kohli throughout was extremely rational and extremely gracious. You obviously didn't see all of it while you were away, but his post-match interviews were, without exception, full of honesty, but also full of grace and praise where it was due. And I thought that at the end, the on-field and off-field tributes that India paid to Alastair Cook were absolutely superb. Tell me what, I've not been for many years, I'm a Lord's man these days, what was the overall experience like at the Oval on a Test match day?
It's a great experience there. I mean, you obviously at Lord's you don't have people dressing up in fancy dress and that type of thing. It was great atmosphere. There was a mixture of England and Indian fans there, all getting on very well. You do get that sort of, well, they used to call it the Barmy Army, didn't they? I don't know whether it still is the official Barmy Army, but you do get sections of the crowd who sort of fall into that Barmy Army thing where they sing all day long. Fortunately, we weren't sitting too near one particular section. I did feel a bit sorry for some of the fans who were sitting directly in front of this particular section. They sung the same songs constantly all day, which was all right maybe 20 years ago when you're at the SCG and all that, but when you're at the Oval, it can be a little bit tiresome, I think, if somebody's directly behind you. But we were fine, and it was a really good day. It was packed out. The weather held. I think there were forecasts of it raining. We had a tiny spot of rain at the end, but generally it was a good fun. I mean, I don't think I've ever had a bad day's experience at a Test match, whichever ground it's at. I mean, I like the Oval because it's quite convenient. But it was great fun. Really good.
Well, that's excellent to hear. And the facilities have improved hand over fist at the Oval in the last 15, 20 years.
Definitely.
Which is a good, because it was a very tired, downbeat old dump.
I mean, they've got plenty of catering facilities now, and they're, I guess, like a lot of other cricket grounds, they're bringing in this plastic cup thing where there's no cup strewn around. Everybody puts a deposit on their cup, and they're taken back at the end, and there's plenty of different types of food you can eat, and all sorts of other things going on there, which sponsors put on. I think Specsavers had a fielding cage where you had to try and catch a ball and throw it into various holes to get the record score. They claimed Alastair Cook had the record of 280. A friend of mine went on it and got zero, couldn't even get one ball into the hole. So if Alastair Cook got 280, he was doing very, very well. So
nothing if not a competitive individual, whatever he's doing.
Yes,
and
exactly.
And an admirable cricketer. And let's not go down the Alastair Cook route but that said, a man who understood his limitations and did everything he could to utterly maximise every drop of his potential.
Oh yes, and let's hope not, but could be one of the last proper Test batsmen for England that can actually grind out a Test. We're lacking somebody who can fill his shoes at the moment, I'm
unless
afraid.
We find a few butlers who have got the ability to moderate their game according to circumstances. I think you're right, but I don't think anybody will ever score 12,000 Test runs for England.
Well, you're just even playing that amount of Tests to get near that score is going to be phenomenal, whether they get the runs or not. But yeah, I think you're right. I think they're going to struggle to get anywhere near that.
Well, the way the captain's been batting, apart from this last innings, and given the captain's body language, I doubt very much that Root will play anywhere like 160 tests in any case.
Isn't it weird? I thought when Root came into the England team that he would break every record going, assuming he didn't get injured. Since he's taken on the captaincy, his mind seems to be elsewhere when he's batting. It's obviously resting very heavy on his shoulders.
It never stops, though, does it, Tim? I mean, they're off to Sri Lanka for the one-day matches in a fortnight's time, before the end of this month.
I know, it's mad.
It just doesn't stop.
Yep.
And interestingly, you know, the press are all over everything, aren't they? The latest thing is a knighthood for Alastair Cook. But anyway, let's head to my evening last evening, back at the RAC, because a friend of mine is a member there, and and this was only really an hour's worth. It was a lot to go up for, quite honestly, in a very busy day. But they did an hour's question and answer with dear old Henry Blofeld. And he was very much as you would expect. We said afterwards that it was sadly manifest that he's nearer 80 than 70 now. I do it myself, heaven knows, and Henry's got a few years on me. It's so easy, particularly if you are a raconteur. You go off at tangents and you lose the thread.
Yeah.
And several times last night he said, what was the original question?
Yeah.
But
yeah,
that's because he's spinning a yarn all the time. And the totally unchanged Etonian tones. And very, very interesting. I mean, if you're my age, perhaps not so much people younger, but if you're my age, you've really heard it all before. Mm. I think there was only one thing that came absolutely fresh to me, which was a slightly scurrilous tale he told about Howard Marshall, who was the doyen, the original 1930s BBC radio commentator. And there's a bit still in the archives. They kept Howard Marshall's commentary when Hutton got his 364 at the Oval in 1938. But Blofeld told this story about Howard Marshall was a handsome man and had an eye for the ladies, and after the war Lord Reith wouldn't let him back on the BBC because of that. Well, I did a bit of digging this afternoon on the wonderful internet, and Lord Reith actually left the BBC in 1938.
Right, yes.
But
okay,
Blofeld, of course, was a considerable cricketer, and had he not had his accident, gone over the handlebars of his motorbike and headed a bus when he was still at Eton, he was still good enough to play for Cambridge.
He was a wicketkeeper, wasn't he?
He was a wicketkeeper batsman. He was still good enough to play for Cambridge, and he was able to talk last night about playing against David Shepherd and Fred Truman and Brian Statham and playing with Ted Dexter and so on and so forth. But rather, as we all do, I hope, touching wood, that I've escaped the trap so far, as old men will, when he was asked who was the best and who was the greatest, it was all Dennis Compton, Peter May, it was all back 50 and 60 years ago. And I suppose that's when people do make an impression. To me, in the whole of my life, there's Garfield Sobers and there's Ian Botham, and you can forget the rest, quite honestly.
I think with Henry Blofeld, I think the only time in his career where he ever sort of showed sort of weakness, if you like, was he briefly had a spell on I think it was when Sky first launched their coverage, and he was one of the first commentators to go to Sky, and it didn't really translate the way he came across on radio. And I think that was the only time he wasn't there long, and I think he quickly realised that the TV wasn't necessarily his forte.
I sat just behind him a couple of years ago. I was invited to a Lashings game, the first time they ever played at Worthing, where my old friend Harry Newton's old friend Derek Sements is still a club member. If there was over 80s cricket in Sussex, Derek would be playing it, I think. But we sat behind Blofeld for a while because he was doing a sort of commentary come announcing, and he did it rather like radio commentary, and he just about managed to carry it off.
Yeah.
But I know exactly what you mean. I mean, you've heard me say on this show before that last winter I found that Ali Mitchell translated absolutely dreadfully from radio to the BT Sport thing.
It's funny how it's a completely different sort of forum, isn't it, really? And the skills are different. I saw Henry Blofeld at a Lashings game in Newdigate a few years ago when they did a fundraising match for the new pavilion, which has obviously now been completed, and he did the same thing that day. He did a commentary and an announcement type of thing, but it was very good. He only did half the match. He handed over to another commentator. I can't remember who was doing it, but he was good at it. But I think it's probably, I mean, you saw him last night. He's probably reached the point now, and I think it was coming across in some of his final radio commentaries where you could tell that he was maybe reaching his peak. Let's put it that way.
Yes. What really brought it home to me last night, ancient as I now am, was that he was able to sit there and say to the assembled audience, "I am, of course, the last member of TMS to have worked with John Arlott."
Wow. Yeah, and I guess that's true, isn't it?
That
was that
really,
Jonathan Agnew wouldn't
that really
it, because,
made me
1980,
think. 1980, Agnew was still playing.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, Agnew worked with Brian Johnston, hence the infamous Legover recording. But no, there we are. Tim, I'm going to hold things up in a minute because I've got to do these local league finishing positions. And as we said, you know, it's flying by.
as it always does.
I can see through the glass in Studio 2, John Stockley showing our first game. guest how to work the panel. But before we do that, just tell me what you told me earlier about TalkSport and TMS.
Yes, it was announced today that TalkSport have gained the rights to the 2019-2020 overseas tour to South Africa. They'd already got the rights to this winter's tour in Sri Lanka and the West Indies, but now they've got the rights to the following winter's tour as well, so there'll be no TMS come winter time for at least 2 years.
It's the marketplace, I suppose, yeah. And the BBC hasn't got the clout or the money that it once had.
No. I'm a big fan of TalkSport, and they do a really good job, but I have to say I'm an even bigger fan of TMS, and I was quite saddened today that they hadn't managed to get that particular tour, having already lost the first tour this winter. But there we go, as you say, that is the market.
I know a lot of people don't have it, but I also hope very much that that Sky managed to hold on to the bulk of the overseas cricket, because I thought that that really put a dent in my enjoyment of last winter.
Yeah, it was BT, wasn't it? And it's unfortunately, they did show that they were a channel that hadn't really done it properly before. And when you look at Sky's TV coverage, they've really taken it to the next level. And they've got some absolutely superb people on that team as well. I mean, the likes of Gower, Botham, Willis, you know, even some of the pundits coming through are fantastic.
Oh, the next generation, you know. And you've got Pop, Issa Guha and Ebony Rainford Brent into that as well.
Exactly.
Not perhaps some of the others, but let's not go there for now. Now, you can sit and look smug for 3 minutes while I attempt to get what I'm going to do next into 2 minutes and 48 seconds in the same way as I do on a Wednesday afternoon. This is the roundup of the league finishing position. We'll see how we go. In the Surrey Championship, Weybridge won the Premier Division with 301 points, Reigate Priory second on 282. Banstead's return to the top flight produced a fifth-place finish. Chipstead, Coulston, Walcantians are relegated from Division 1. In Division 2, Dorking were 20 points short of promotion in third place. Oxted and Limpsfield avoided relegation by 1 point. Merston were fifth in Division 5, 55 points off the promotion places. In the Fuller's Premiership, Lingfield came third, 43 points short of promotion. Fewer than 30 points separated Cholton CMO in fourth and Whiteley Village, who were relegated. Newdigate survive in eighth place, 9 points above the safety line. In Division 1, Hawley were fifth, 35 points off the promotion places. In Surrey Downs Division 1, South Nutfield bounced back this year to finish second, 24 points shy of winners East Horsley, but a massive 150 points clear of Salford's in third. Tadworth, Nutfield and Capel fill places 4-6. North Holmwood in eighth avoided relegation by 7 points. In Division 2, Headley Old Freemans are runaway winners. They're promoted with Woldingham Village, Brockham Green were fourth. In the Sussex Premiership, Roffey are emphatic winners, 52 points clear of second-placed Eastbourne. Roffey made 445 points. East Grinstead fourth this year on 370, 13 clear of Horsham in fifth. Ifield were bottom and are relegated, having struggled all season. Three Bridges top Division 2 by 23 points on 422, winning their season's battle with Mayfield, who are promoted alongside them. Division 3 East sees Crawley Eagles fourth, 89 points short of winners Burgess Hill. In West Division 4, Crawley recovered from a poor start to finish fifth. And finally, Outwood in the Kent County Village League are promoted from Division 2 as champions, 28 points clear of Bearsted, who also go up. And Outwood 2s are promoted from Division 7 as champions, also heading Bearsted, this time by 21 points. Otford in third are also promoted. Outwood also reached the semi-final of the inaugural Surrey Slam. So by any yardstick, Outwood are on the front foot's Club of the Year for 2018. There we are, I managed that, Tim, only one fluff.
Well done, that was good.
That's nearly got us to the bottom of the hour and the arrival of our first guest, but we've got 2 or 3 minutes. The ultimate Reigate Priory choke took place before you went on holiday. Were you here when the East Molesey tie took place?
No, I think I might have been away.
Well, Weybridge had lost to bottom club East Molesey the week before, and although Priory lost to Sutton, they actually increased the gap by 1 point to 11 points as a result of all that. But then Priory played East Molesey the following week and were promptly bowled out for 76 by the bottom club, who, incidentally, courtesy of those two wins, survived in the Premiership. 58 for 2 East Molesey, and then the leg spinner Michael Mundy was called up, 4.2 overs, 6 for 10, match tied. bid, 76 each. So it was all on Priory against Weybridge at Park Lane on the bank holiday Saturday, and Weybridge brushed them aside, 119, and five wickets win. Perhaps fortunately, because we know what things get said these days, Weybridge didn't have to pick Tom Curran, but they did. And Ben Curran, who plays for Northants, was also playing. But Tom Curran made no material contribution to the game. He was out, I think, for four and took one wicket. But Outwood, you know, just strength to strength.
Yeah,
it's been
fantastic.
Quite extraordinary.
They've been a cracking little club, Outwood, and we've had guests on from Outwood over the last few seasons, and they're a real friend to this show, and I think quite rightly. I mean, there are other clubs that have run them close, but I think quite rightly they've won our Club of the Year this year.
And we'll invite somebody. I don't know whether it'll be John Hall again, but I'm talking to Phil Yent about it. Be nice to have one of the younger players, maybe get the captain in, but we'll get somebody in, and we'll hand them over a little certificate on the next show. Let's just say the next show is a week late as well.
Yes, that's right, second week of October.
Commitments on the 4th, so yes. The next show will be on Thursday the 11th of October. And we'll really do the league roundup then, which is why I wanted to do the results in that slab.
Sussex and Surrey's 103.4.
Tim, on the day that Surrey won the county championship, we haven't even mentioned the fact in the first half hour.
I know, not more. We were going to mention it, but we got
waylaid
with other stuff.
Yeah,
didn't
but
we?
we'll perhaps save that for the last half hour my old pal Andy Tharp is here. Now, I said that we were going to take a look at some friendly cricket, some non-league cricket this evening, and I'm delighted that our first guest is from Lye, just down the road between Reigate and Newdigate, and Kanna Shanmugam, it's an absolute pleasure to welcome you to Suzy 103.4.
Thank you very much, Ted. It's a pleasure to be here.
You were telling me that you were smitten, as it were, by Lye at first acquaintance.
Absolutely. I think from the moment I walked in and I met the people that were there, I was very much felt at home. And I've been there 10 years, and it hasn't changed one bit. If anything, I feel more at home now. And for me, the key thing is I wanted to bring in people that I thought would help the club, would maintain that camaraderie and team spirit. And I think that's what we try to do. And that's kind of what we try and do when we encourage new people to join, is to get involved with the club and get involved with the activities and have fun, really.
Now, without giving too much away, I've been involved not with the club as a club so much as a club member, but I taught many of the players who are now your old lags. Are any of the Chenneries or Simon Martin or Mark Holman and Simon Verley, are any of them still around?
So they all still play in the President's 11 game. So it tends to be the current 11 versus Simon Verley, all the Chenneries, Mark Holman comes down. So all of them still turn up and play.
Yeah, well, Mark and Simon were my captain and vice-captain at the grammar school in Reigate. Yeah. I can't believe it, 31 years ago. But there we are. And when you see them, you must remind them of the night that we spent in Southampton University with the rain hammering on the skylight and Mark Holman stranded short of the last game, which was never going to happen, two wickets short of the school record.
Oh.
But presumably he never broke that record then, did he?
No, he didn't.
Never broke it.
I think Toby Briggs broke it long afterwards. Anyway, that's completely by the by. And I'm glad the Chenneries are still going. I played for a wandering side years back, and we used to go down on a Sunday and have a wandering game. Now, do you still play the all day Sunday stuff?
Yes. So the all day Sunday stuff is probably coming to an end. The odd game here or there that we do try and play, but that's kind of a dying breed, and we're trying to play more 40 over games. I think just with the times and families, children and so on, starting an all day game is proving a bit more difficult than
Well, I'm not going to get into an argument with you about that. I have very strong views, but the life's too short and cricket takes so long. But I think the big difference, of course, I mean, we used to thoroughly enjoy it. Magnificent lunch, superb tea, 6.5 hours cricket, and take your time. But there we are. Times change, and we must move with the times. What's the pitch like?
I mean, pitch has improved remarkably. It's become a really good batting track. You know, there are days when you can get 200, 300 easily. So it's become a really, really good track. And a lot of credit goes to the grounds people like Barry, who has done a significant amount of work to, you know, make that pitch really playable, and so many other people help him out.
Yes, I mean, it's been his brainchild for a very long time.
Has the outfield recovered from the summer? I was there at the Live Flower Show earlier in the summer, and it was, I mean, like all of our lawns, it was very brown on the outfield. Is it greening up now?
It is. It's very, very much greening up now.
That's good.
And of course, you do have to share the role, even though you play an awful lot of home games. You have to share the role of Village Green.
Yes.
And that means there are a few events which, let's not say get in the way of cricket. What are the regular things that happen down there over and above?
The regular things would be the flower show would be the big one that happens at the end of July. We also have the bonfire night, which will happen, I think, this year on the 23rd of October. And then also we'll have the annual awards dinner. And the club also, the Wagget Priory under, I think it's 8 and... under 11s use that ground to play their games.
Okay, so, I didn't know that. Yeah, I didn't know that.
Well, that's part of the sort of pyramid structure. I mean, where there's a ground, there are big clubs with all these millions of cult sides. It's perhaps understandable. Tell us a little bit about your favourite fixtures, Canna.
I think some of our favourite fixtures are some of the long-standing ones. So the likes of Mogador that we play every year. Three Bridges is another one. We've also kept the fixtures with Badgers. Minthurst is a new one that we play every after the flower show. Sunday after the flower show, it's been quite a regular one. So those are some of the key ones that we play. RMVR is another.
Most of your games are home games.
Absolutely. Yeah. We've got a really lovely ground, very picturesque, so it makes sense to play as many home games as possible.
I have to say, one of my memories of playing I used to play for Charlwood, and we used to play against Lye on a Sunday, and we were talking about all day games. One of my memories of Lye is on very hot days having a lunch in the pavilion, and it would be Cornish pasty, mashed potatoes, baked beans. And I remember the first time we had the fixture, the first time I played in the fixture anyway, and we were all getting stuck into this food, and it was fairly obvious that the Lye players weren't quite as keen to eat it. And it was only when we realised that after having eaten it on a hot day, you try and field or bat with that inside you, and it was very generous of you guys to make it, but I think there was maybe an ulterior motive that it slowed us down a bit, and perhaps that's some hidden tactic that Lye has used over the years to try and win matches. Maybe, I don't know. Do you still ever do the pasty and the shepherd's mashed potato and the beans?
Yes, I think we've gone to a bit more leaner, a lot more healthier teas, and so Sarah at the Plough pub near Lye, she prepares brilliant teas. It's really good. It's all fresh, and
it always does seem, it's always very welcoming. Whenever we used to play down there at Charlwood, it was always a very welcoming club.
So. Oh, we used to have magnificent time down there on a Sunday. Sarah is quite extraordinary, Sarah Bloomfield. I mean, she's catering for you. She's a linchpin of Newdigate cults as well. She's they used to do, when she was still with Rob, they used to do occasional licences for us at the grammar school when I was still at work for social events. She's a remarkable young lady, is our Sarah. Speaking of cults, does a club like Lye, Canna, need to have a conscious recruitment policy, youth policy?
So for us, it's something that we don't have the infrastructure to do just yet, but it's something that we definitely want to consider, because at the moment there are some days when availability might be short. And that's where we're now tapping into the likes of Wagget Priory to say, you know, if you have any players that are spare, then they're always welcome to come and play with us. So because we don't have that infrastructure to have a cult system, we're leveraging likes of Priory. But it's something that I think we should definitely consider. But the biggest factor for us is that Lye is not a big catchment area. So we're very reliant on other clubs supporting us if possible. But I think, you know, we're going to go on a big drive to recruit more players.
You've got one Saturday team and one Sunday team,
absolutely,
haven't you?
Yeah.
And in terms of sort of club members, how many sort of club members do you have at Leyde?
So we've got about playing members. We've got somewhere between 30 to 60. Some of them are very available every week. Some of them are not so available. But so we've got about 60 people that are active.
I mean, I think that the fact is that you're still going. You're still able to put out two sides of a weekend. Mm. You know, I referred earlier on to my old club, Charlwood, which is sort of next village along almost, isn't it? And unfortunately, Charlwood folded, well, around about 2003, 2004, similar size village. Yeah. We were just not capable of getting any new players in. We didn't investigate the idea of speaking to bigger clubs. Yeah. Maybe that's what we should have done, but we just struggled. We had a whole set of players who'd played for years, who all sort of retired at the same time, and we just couldn't get any youngsters to come in. Yeah. So the fact that you guys are still going, it's great. I mean, it would be a real shame if there was no cricket played there.
I mean, I think our Saturday team is probably the team that probably needs a lot more work than Sunday. The Sunday team tends to fill up pretty quickly, very comfortably, whereas the Saturday doesn't. So that's when we're reaching out, and then that's where we're trying to put more effort into think about other ways of how can we get new players coming in. You know, we're looking at, are there schools that we can speak to locally that can come and play for us? Because a lot of the people that play in our clubs are fathers and sons. So, so, you know, we've got 11-year-olds, 12-year-olds playing with their dads, and that's something that we definitely want to investigate, and that's something that we encourage.
Yeah.
You know, daughters, sons, and playing with us.
And you're going to dabble with a bit of Sunday league cricket next year?
Yes, we are. So what we found was this year especially, some of the teams are cancelling fixtures on a Sunday against us, and because we didn't want to go through that next year, we said, well, let's investigate the possibility of playing in a Sunday league. And the VCL, although it's a league format, it's played in the Sunday spirit, and that's what's drawn us to it. Is although we want to play regular fixtures, it's more we want to play in the right spirit. And that's what this league's offering us. So I think that's
is it a new league, or is it?
It's been going on for quite some time, but
and is it clubs, presumably locally, local clubs?
Yeah,
is it?
Yeah.
Okay.
So the likes of Abinger are there, Ashted, Cranley, I think.
And is it what is it? 40 overs a side?
No, it's an 85 over format. You can bat up to 45 overs, declare, and then...
Okay, so there's draws and time cricket. Yeah. Oh, that's good. That's good.
It's a mixture of both, because you've got league... So you've got time, and got the overs and factors.
I don't know how many teams are in the actual league. Will it take over your entire Sunday fixture list, or will it be friendly still?
Okay, no. So, Brent, the good thing is there's two divisions. We'll be starting off in the second division, and you will play 16 fixtures in the summer, but they're very flexible in the sense that if you've got long-standing fixtures, friendlies that you play, you could keep those.
Right.
And you can go back to the league and say, okay, these dates, I can't play a game.
No, well, that's good. I mean, I think it's a nice, as you say, it's a nice mixture to have friendlies and have some league, because some people like playing league cricket. The important thing, I think you've said quite rightly, is it will be played in the Sunday spirit.
Absolutely.
And that, I think, is the critical thing, because I think a lot of people play Sunday cricket because they don't want to play that. I mean, I've played league cricket on a Saturday, and, you know, I like it, but there can be times when it's not necessarily particularly good-natured.
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's good. Hopefully, I'm sure Lyle will do very well.
We're looking forward to it. We're very excited about it. It's a new adventure, so...
Yeah, excellent.
How about development plans? I mean, the pavilion is not substantially different from the way I remember it 40 years ago, when a chap called Stuart Nicholson, who Tim knows, put a ball clean through the clock one evening
in
a 20 over thrash. Yeah.
So the pavilion is being renovated at the end of this season, so the front of it will look completely.
Does that mean you're going to fix the sign? Because at the moment, the G and the H...
Yes.
And I drive past Leigh Cricket Ground twice a day, on the way to work and on the way back, and it really irritates me when I see that the G and H have dropped off.
We'll make sure it's definitely...
Yeah, make sure you fix that.
Tim, that sounds exactly like a Conservative Party conference.
Yes, indeed.
So, to what extent will the renovations involve the actual dressing rooms and space and refurbished showers and stuff?
At the moment, we're only looking at the front. We've made it structurally very safe, and we're now looking at things like verandas. So that may be a future step that we look at.
But I always thought any any changing facilities that were predicated on, let's say, the kit that people had just after the war, and then all of a sudden you've got one person's cricket bag practically fills a dressing room and so on and so forth. While you're here, Canner, I'm sure we'd both enjoy broadening out the discussion a little bit, but is there anything else from your perspective that you'd like to share with us about Lye at this stage?
I mean, I think for me it's more to just give kind of an update on kind of what Lye's about and how I think, well, you know, what we do and what we do very well.
You come in from Kenley, don't you? You don't live in Lye,
no,
do you?
No, there's not too many people that actually live in Lye. A lot of people, I mean, this is kind of a strength of why the club is so good, is that there's so many people that travel from Guildford, 30, 40 minutes to an hour, to actually come and play for Lye.
I think that's the lifeblood, isn't it, of a village size these days. You can't, I mean, that we're talking about Charwood, that's why Charwood failed. Mm. I guess it's why Lye hasn't failed, is because you include players and you're happy for people to come and play for Lye, even if they live, well, Kenley and beyond.
Absolutely.
And it's interesting that you've decided to go the Sunday League, the Development League route, and keep playing friendly cricket on Saturdays.
Which
is really totally bucking the trend.
I think it's a great idea.
What a marvellous thing for Saturday players to be able to play some, let's not say old-fashioned, say traditional cricket on a Saturday without all those pressures. Canna, we see month in, month out here, sides under pressure of, avoiding relegation by a couple of points or whatever it may be. And I suppose that does add to the frayed tempers. Let's talk about it now. One of the items on our long list is a game, I think it was a third team game in the Hampshire League, where one of the players ended up headbutting and quite seriously injuring the umpire. Now, we, being involved with a number of umpires, Howard Cohen, who's the South East Regional Educational Officer, was on our first show of the year, and we talked quite a lot about it's all very well training umpires and so on and so forth, but most of the time in the real world it's not trained or appointed umpires, it's poor old 9-10 Jack with a white coat, and every bit is responsible for implementing these incredibly complicated laws. Can I go off at a tangent, Canna? If you approach the average Lye player, would the average Lye player be aware that there's a new set of laws this year? And if the player were aware, do you find that the new laws have impinged in any way on the cricket you're playing?
I mean, I don't think the average player would be aware of the new laws. I don't think they have really radically changed the way we play cricket. I think because it's friendly cricket that we play, there isn't too much questioning of the umpire. You know, you take, and generally the umpire is your teammate, so whatever decision he or she makes, you accept it, you move on.
Yeah, I think that's probably fair enough. I think league cricket is probably where issues can arise when, as you say, 9, 10, 11 are umpiring because nobody else will.
At third and fourth team level, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. I think in friendly cricket, it's probably accepted, isn't it, that you're probably not going to have a stat. I'm assuming you don't have an actual umpire that umpires, and you take turn in umpiring.
Absolutely. You start from number five and work your way down.
Exactly. And everybody goes and hides when the captain comes looking for the umpire.
And what that effectively is going to mean, that your friendly cricket pretty much carries on in its own sweet way, the same as it always has, with the 2000 code that's been amended 11 times or whatever it is.
But the incident you mentioned with the headbutt, I think you said earlier on when we were talking off air that the umpire was actually a player, wasn't it? It wasn't an actual umpire, it was a player standing in as the umpire that ended up being
which
headbutt.
Is why I wandered down the lane we've just wandered down, because ultimately they're every bit as responsible. But it happens, and I suppose when points are at stake. But people, I think he got a year's ban. I don't think he got a lifetime ban.
No, he didn't. He was told, apparently, that they said, and it sounds ridiculous given that he headbutted the umpire, but apparently he only got a year's ban because it was his first offence. Personally, I would have banned him for life of doing that. It's just outrageous. The guy lost a tooth, and it was terrible. And I'm sure I read that there'd been a previous incident a couple of weeks before, not necessarily with the same player, but there'd been another incident. So, you know, it's terrible when, I mean, these things going on. I mean, you know, that's why people like playing friendly cricket, don't they? And as you said earlier on, that's what, you know, Lye try and engender.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
And when I was still umpiring school first-team cricket, Canna, after I gave up running the side at Reigate, especially down in Sussex, I came across stacks of umpires who'd come back to do senior school cricket, under 18 cricket, proper cricket, but they just couldn't stand the handbags at 10 paces in the league all the time. And that does filter over. Okay, secondary question then. I don't think anybody's had the real idea about penalty time, Tim, and all the other wonderful things that we listened to back in February. Not from Howard, I hasten to add, the seminar that we went to. What about women's cricket in general, Canna, and women playing members at Lye?
So we do have a few playing members, but what we tried to do is Newdigate hosted a six-a-side, a female Surrey Foundation cricket tournament at the end of August. So Lye put a team forward. I think we put four or five people, partners that went in and enjoyed it. And there was talk of, right, how could we then work with Newdigate and get a game going? So I think Newdigate have arranged a game against Effingham for September, which some of the Lye members are going to be then participating.
And you had your Newdigate and Lye mums in the pouring rain two Sundays ago at John Colcutt's little Prosecco Fest.
Yes.
I've known John for very, very many years. He's a wonderful man. He's a great friend of the radio station and this show in particular. And I couldn't be more delighted that he's just had an award from Surrey County Cricket Club for lifetime services to cricket.
Well deserved.
He is an absolutely splendid chap. Well, that's good. Now, I don't beat about the bush, so if I'm out of order, Canna, you must just tell me. I'm going to ask you straight out. Your heritage is Sri Lankan.
Yes, it is.
And are you from Sri Lanka?
Yes, I am.
You are. So, okay.
Yeah.
So, first time over here. Now, let's, in that case, if we may, 6 minutes or so until we have to bid our fond farewells. We'll talk about England India later, Tim. How do you, as a native Sri Lankan, see the up and coming series of ODIs and then test matches in November? Our lot are getting on the plane in a fortnight's time, for heaven's sake.
I think in test cricket in general, what's happened is the home side has started producing wickets that considerably just favours them. Sri Lanka went over to South Africa, got turned over, then South Africa came back and Sri Lanka turned them over really comfortably. And my worry is that Sri Lanka can prepare a wicket that will just absolutely turn from ball one. You know, they were opening with spinners, which you don't normally see. What I hope is it's going to be fairer, it's going to be more balanced, but my worry is because there is a expectation that your home side has to win the game, therefore they're going to produce wickets which are going to favour them massively. And while the one days might be more about where I expect England to win, but I think England may struggle in the test matches just because of the wickets.
Rangana Herath may not be the most mobile of fielders, but he has become a serious 400 plus wicket spin bowler.
Yeah, he has. I mean, he's lived in Murali's shadows for a very long time, and it's only since his retirement has he actually been able to play and show what he can really do. But I think he's gone 40 now, so
I didn't realise that he was tapping on as much as that. So you think it'll turn a bit, and then the English batsmen will have the other half of their technique tested. I suppose you're absolutely right about home advantage, but we were saying in the first bit of the show that India in fact have the quick bowlers now to have flourished. Bob Willis kept on saying they must be absolutely sick to lose 4-1, having bowled as well as they have. A couple of tosses the other way. So many test matches in such short order.
I know, it's not like the old days where you had the summer series and you waited a few months and there was a winter series around about sort of December. Now, as David just said, they've just finished the series. They get on the plane in two weeks and they're over in Sri Lanka. And then there's the West Indies tournament as well. And then it's back to English cricket next summer. So it just rolls around, doesn't it, these days?
And what an utterly marvellous man Kumar Sangakkara is.
He is. There's not many superlatives to describe him, I think. He's an elegant batsman and very articulate, I think. Just listening to him in commentary, it was good. It's very good.
I found it very interesting on Sky that a couple of years ago they did a so-called masterclass on the outfield at Durham on a wet day in April, and he sounded, for such an articulate man, I mean, he did the Cowdery lecture, didn't he, and all sorts. He sounded a bit out of his depth doing that, But as soon as he got in that commentary box this year, he flourished and grew and grew and grew. And what an irony that he's been overtaken by Alistair Cook, in the sense that to watch, you couldn't have two more different performers.
Yeah. Well, yes, exactly, yeah. I mean, they are very different, aren't they?
They are very different. I mean, Alistair Cook, though, to his credit, has done amazingly well. You know, he served English cricket brilliantly, and he is rightly regarded as the best English opener, I think, that's been around. And the fact that the amount of runs that he's accumulated, and he's now in the top five, I believe, of the all-time record, and he's the only opener there, I think it's credit to it's more his mental strength rather than his ability.
Yeah.
You know, to grind runs out, it's...
Absolutely, and it's a rarity, isn't it, in first-class cricket, in club cricket, never mind first-class cricket, let alone international cricket, for somebody to retire with... universal views what a nice man Alistair Cook is, you know.
Yeah.
And I was actually quite pleased, in amongst all of the chit-chat that's gone on this last 10 days or so, that when he had the opportunity, he didn't beat about the bush, and he said how disappointed he was that he had copped all the flack for the Peterson thing, which he didn't originally want to happen himself, but which he went along with, and he was the one who was then vilified on social media by Piers Morgan upwards.
It was a real shame, because, as you say, Cook always comes across as such a decent bloke, and somebody who you'd be very surprised if he'd been the instigator of that whole incident, if we call it an incident. He obviously was in the middle of it as captain, but you know, he comes across, whenever he's interviewed, he always comes across as such a nice, decent bloke, which, you know, is testament to him. His, as you said earlier on, Canna, his mental strength is clearly incredible, to be able to accumulate the runs he did. Will we get another player like him who can do that? Don't know. That's the problem we're facing, isn't it?
Canna, there may not be all the ups and downs and excitements and tables and significance of results to talk about with non-league cricket, but I, for one, going back a long time now, I'm absolutely delighted that Lye doesn't just continue to fly the flag, but flourishes. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you in on the front foot this evening, and you will come back and see us again, won't you?
Absolutely. Thank you very much for having me.
Let us know how the league season goes, if that starts next year, and as I say, do give my regards to any of my old lags who you happen to see. And Canna Shanmugam from Lye Cricket Club, thank you ever so much for coming in this evening.
Thank you very much.
I know we say it every month, but it flies when you're having fun. And how refreshing to have a representative of a side that isn't forever chasing points, let alone headbutting umpires, eh? Well, that was Lye. We're going back to the league, and one of the sides that was in that very exciting Fuller's Premier wash-up, in which Newdigate survived by 9 points, or whatever it may have been, that's Godalming. They'll be with us after news at the top of the hour. Welcome back to the second hour of On the Front Foot for the month of September. Tim Bowling, the other side of the panel. David Jay, this side of the mic. We've played musical chairs. And I'm delighted, without further ado now, to welcome a representative of a club from out of our FM area, but we do try from time to time to look at different areas of Sussex and of Surrey. Nigel Churaman from Godalming Cricket Club, good evening and welcome to Suzy 103.4.
Thank you, David. Thank you for having me.
It's an absolute pleasure to have you here. Now, we just did a little sound check, and you were able to tell us a bit about your backstory. So do please share that with the listeners.
That's very kind, David. So many, many years ago, I've obviously played cricket for the entirety of my adult life and childhood. But for me, the most important thing was in 1997, I happened to play international cricket for Gibraltar in the ICC World Cup, the Champions Trophy. Prior to that, I played in one European Cup, and after the World Cup, ended up playing one further European Cup. Playing for Gibraltar in Malaysia, an experience that lasted 3 weeks, a phenomenal experience, a taste of maybe just an insight of what first-class cricketers experience, if just a soupçon of it. In terms of personal success, it was by far my, I suppose, 15 minutes of fame.
That's absolutely fascinating. Now, something, a question I've never asked, I wouldn't know the answer. Is there a cricket ground on Gibraltar?
There are two cricket grounds in Gibraltar. Neither of them have any turf, and it's played on matting with an outfield of gravel, best described. Now, I have not stepped foot on the shores of Gibraltar for some 20-odd years. Any change in that, I could not be absolutely certain.
Were you born in Gibraltar?
No, I wasn't born in
so
Gibraltar.
So what's your link to Gibraltar?
The link to Gibraltar is a tenuous one, and maybe one we shouldn't go into detail on this show.
Okay, fine.
We are still before the watershed.
Correct.
We need to talk about Godalming, Nigel, but I'm fascinated. I'd like to pursue this because... I'd worked for very many years at the grammar school in Reigate, and we have very strong connections in general, and with cricket in particular, with the island of Jersey. And so over the last 10 or 15 years, since Jersey took the decision to come away from the ECB and go in with the whole ICC World Leagues, and I think they're currently in Div 4 or Div 5, I never know which, they bounce up and down like this, I've seen quite a bit of it, and to me it's absolutely phenomenal that you've got Guernsey and Jersey and the Isle of Man and Gibraltar. We had a gentleman in the spring who was connected with Iceland,
yes,
didn't we?
Yes, Darren Talbot.
Darren Talbot,
yeah. Iceland coach. Yeah.
I mean, going back in 1997, we played teams like Israel, Argentina, the European countries, for obvious reasons. But cricket's no different to football. It should be a game of the people. It's an international sport.
I assume it's mainly expats, though, that are playing for those sort of sides, is it?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the cricket would have been introduced to those countries by expats. Mm. But still, it's an exposure to cricket in a culture, in a country that brings through different generations exposed to the game.
Yeah.
And that's important.
Yeah, no, you're right.
And, Nigel, obviously it's expanded, not just the European stuff, Jersey in World Cricket League Division 4 and 5, they've been to Los Angeles for a whole tournament, they've been to Tanzania, they've been to Malaysia twice. At home, I've seen them play Oman and Vanuatu and somewhere else that I couldn't pronounce from way out in the middle of the Pacific. So it really is a wonderful expanding thing, and they're playing 50 over and 20 over tournaments. So let's come back a little nearer to home, because it's probably 30 years, maybe more, since I played on a Sunday at Holloway Hill, friendly cricket in those days completely, and we had a tie, 199 each, which was the wandering side from Caterham that I used to play for, and I doubt whether I could even find my way up there now, but it's Main Street, turn left and go up, isn't it?
You're absolutely spot on, and nothing has changed since. The club still exists at the top of the hill, looking down onto Godalming, backdrop of a bowling green, tennis courts, a new pavilion since you were last there, a fantastic pavilion, facilities are phenomenal.
And am I right from these long ago recollections that we might have played on the second pitch rather than the first, two pitches?
That's right, there are two pitches there, and Sundays would have been predominantly, if it was second 11 cricket, would have been on the second pitch as opposed to the first pitch. But the club would have changed in all recognition, certainly aesthetically, from when you were there. Change of rooms now, we can cater for four teams up there at any one time, with showers, full facilities, electric scoreboard. It really is a club that has moved with the times.
Well, that's splendid to hear. Now, were you in at the bottom of the league formation? I mean, it's been going so long now, I still think of it as an innovation, but been in the Fullers throughout.
When we started league cricket, it would have been the three counties, more than three counties, before that was disbanded and then filtered into what was Fullers. We have enjoyed predominantly most of our existence in the Fullers, but we did actually enter the Surrey Championship 3 or 4 years ago, both teams, first and second 11. Sadly, we have slipped down and gone back to the Fullers, both the first 11 and the second 11. The first 11 are in the Premier, and the second 11 are in Division 1. And that has been the case now for the last 3 years.
it's quite interesting that our local side here, Merstham, had a succession of promotions through the Division 1 Premier of the Fullers, and have managed to hold their own in Surrey Championship Division 5, whereas Merrow, who were their absolute tooth and nail, 3 points apart rivals through all those three successive promotions, have been relegated from Div 5. Merstham have actually done very well there. And you may have heard us, I think you might have been listening at the back to the first half hour, our great friend of our show, John Colcutt at Newdigate, you were actually very closely involved in that last day of the season wash-up, weren't you, in the Fullers Premiership?
That's right.
You won and Whiteley Village didn't.
That's right.
And thus was Newdigate's premiership status preserved in eighth place. But as I said in that run through, it was only about 30 points separating third place.
I mean, you can imagine as a club, as a team, a skipper, captain, James Clark, went through every single scenario over the last two or three games, and the tightness of it was such that actually two or three wins took you into the top four or five. I mean, that was the closeness of the whole division. Fortunately for us, we got through at the end, and I think deservedly so.
Well, that's very good to hear, because it's quite an interesting division to me. Newdigate are almost the odd side out, in that I imagine, even though it's a relatively small town, Godalming would think of itself as a town club rather than a village club. Two pitches, renovated,
absolutely,
and so on.
Absolutely. I mean, we certainly describe ourselves as a town club. The challenge we have is that within Godalming you also have Farncombe.
Yes, indeed.
And you are surrounded by a number of villages who play in the Iansen, which is village cricket. So the draw of cricketers is wide, but we are competing with many, many clubs. And that's a challenge, I suspect, for most clubs in club cricket, which is availability and the opportunity to have players joining. It continues to be an issue. We have at least 45 play-in members. Now, to get two teams out every weekend, the stars have to be aligned for all availabilities to work. And that's a challenge.
There's no declaration cricket in the Fullers League, is there?
Yes, there is. There is time cricket. And what we have is the first four games are limited overs, as it were. There's a win and lose situation. And in between that is time cricket, where you declare. There is a limitation on overs you can play, but it is much more tactical.
What's the balance of sort of age groups within the teams at Godalming?
The makeup of the teams? That's a very good question, and that's actually something we're very proud of. And due to the lack of availability, as a club, close season of last year, we took the view that actually the future of the club lies within. It lies within a cold section and bringing those people through. I made a decision, along with the other members, that the second 11, we would actually promote three under 15, under 16 players. And in those, Finn Bickerdike, Thomas Woodgate, Thomas Hitchcock, they played a second 11 season with me. Initially, they were a little bit dubious about playing, but over a period of three or four games, they've now become the
It's amazing how It's amazing how quickly the youngsters, when they come into third and second 11 cricket, can adapt to that and
absolutely
actually flourish within that format.
There's an element of fear, initially. There's an element of they're only ever been exposed to 20-over cricket, so the length of the day and the concentration levels become harder. But what they learn very quickly, that cricket's cricket.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, their enjoyment from it and what they're able to contribute over a season far outweighs any...
It always makes me smile when I've generally played in recent years in third 11 cricket, and it's always makes me smile when we always push through lots of Colts at Leatherhead Cricket Club, where I play.
Yeah.
And the third 11 especially is used to bring Colts through. And it's amazing how often in league cricket a Colt will come in 14 or 15, the captain fielding team brings the field in, and I'll be at the other end maybe, or watching, thinking they don't want to do that, and and the Colt bang straight over the top, and immediately the field goes back. And it, the amount of times that happens, it always raises a smile for me to see these youngsters come in, and they may have fear, but it's inside. They once they get out there, they play. And exposing them to adult cricket is
absolutely
brilliant.
And I think the key is as a team, as seniors in a team, is to allow them to fail.
Yeah, yeah.
You have to allow them to fail.
When you put those under-15s in the side, do you push them up the order, let the batsman bat and let the bowlers bowl?
My personal view on any of this form of cricket is that once you have people playing in the side, they have to have a role.
Mm.
If you do not give them a role, they are nothing other than a filler in.
Yeah.
So they have to have a role. Mm. Now, you decide as best as you can with them what I think that role will be.
Yeah.
Two things happen. Firstly, they're grateful to be given a role. And secondly, I tell them that role will exist throughout the entire season.
Mm.
So it allows them to fail.
Yeah.
But it allows them to know they have an opportunity next week and the week after.
Yeah.
Over a period of 4, 5, 6 weeks, you physically, in front of you, see them grow. Mm. In their body language, in their contribution, in their camaraderie within the team. I mean, it really is something. This season, and we struggled as a second 11, I'm really proud of, to have survived with what was 40%, 50% of my youth and Colts cricket.
Mm.
Now, that's a fantastic achievement, because the future bodes well.
Yeah.
It can only bode well.
Yeah. How many Colts, then, and your Colts setup, how many Colts do you have at Godalming?
Well, let's start from the beginning. So, train on a Friday. On a Friday, we will have, from the under-9s all the way to the under-15s, 16-year-olds, I would hazard a guess we would have, on a very sunny day, no rain, we would have in the region of about 70.
And how many of those do you find come through from... You talked about bringing Colts into the second 11. It's always a difficult period when they sort of get to that age where maybe they then go off to university or whatever.
Correct.
Do you find that you're keeping a percentage? They come back from university and come back to play for Godalming?
So there is a percentage of the comeback.
Yeah.
I think the rhythm of life allows, you know, in the modern day, people go off to university, some don't come back, some go into London, the commute becomes an issue. We hold on to a fair proportion. Now, at the ages of 9, 10, 11, 12, that age group will drift as they get closer to 15, 16. The love of cricket or the appetite for cricket becomes distracted and they find other things. Of the ones who remain at 15, 16, you're looking at very few numbers, small numbers, and the majority of them will come back. To give you an example, first 11, over the last 4 or 5 years, I would suspect has made up 80% of Colt cricketers who came through Godalming Colt system. And that is testament of where our energy
definitely
should lie.
Yeah.
That's where it has to lie. The other issue we have is we're seeing more and more, not only in club cricket, but international cricket. We're talking about the next international cricketer England produces that doesn't come from a background of private education. Now, the local schools, for whatever issues, and there are numerous, cannot give cricket the exposure it needs to. So without clubs like Godalming, we are missing the opportunity of exposing cricket and giving cricket to an opportunity and a generation of children who will never ever play the sport. And that concerns me, it worries me, it saddens me. As a club, we do our best. We really do, but like any club out there, we require volunteers, we require help, and that's a different subject matter and for another day.
Yeah, I suppose that's true, and you're also doing that now against the background in the last, 10 or 15 years of the whole setup that's been created around child protection and safeguarding as well. And I'm quite sure, and I'm not waving a flag to say let's go back to the old ways,
no,
but I'm quite sure that does deter some willing volunteers who just don't want to be taken the wrong way or whatever.
Yeah.
Can I change tack just slightly? You mentioned Farnham, and I don't know whether you've got
Farncombe.
I don't know whether you've got much competition with those immediate local rivals for junior players. Would there ever be talk of a super club of Farncombe and Godalming merging?
Now, that's a very good question, and I have to be careful here. careful in the sense that I think I speak for both clubs when I think both of them have an appetite to retain their own identity.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first and foremost. Farncombe made the decision at the end of last season to depart the Fullers League and entered into the Janssen League.
Okay.
I suspect, and I don't speak for them, based on the fact that availability was a problem and the less travelling for their players became more attractive in gaining availability. So we have gone in slightly separate directions over the last season. There certainly isn't an appetite for a super club. I think there is a danger of energising and putting together two super clubs. What tends to happen over a period of time, unless carefully monitored and as custodians of it, that also shrinks as well eventually.
Mm-hmm.
And then what you have was what once were two clubs becomes a very small one club.
Well, there's always the danger of one club just totally dominating the partnership. And we had the same thing at Leatherhead. I think in about 2006 we merged with Cobham.
Right.
And it became... exactly what you said. It became Leatherhead with two Cobham players, and we used to use Cobham's ground. Eventually, Cobham Rugby Club booted Leatherhead off, and we ended up as Leatherhead again.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so you're right. It can be very difficult when you're trying to merge teams together.
Yeah.
One club ends up dominating, and you just become one club again that's smaller. So
I mean, we played a penultimate game against. It escapes me, but it will come to me shortly. That were three clubs amalgamated into one, and having spent some time with them afterwards and talking about it, actually there is no identity.
Well, it's been happening around here for a long, long time. I mean, two of the biggest clubs in Surrey 40 years ago are now Oxted and Limpsfield, and you know, they would have been regarded as two of the top five clubs certainly in East Surrey all that time ago. We have Kenley, Selsdon and Southern Rail. East Coolsdon went in with Chipstead and became Chipstead and Coolsdon. They're now Chipstead, Coolsdon, Walcountians. Cholton have gone in with Croydon MO, which always confuses me because I start saying Cholton CMO or whatever. But there is no doubt. And I asked you the question, Nigel, purely because our good friends, again, slightly out of area like yourselves, at Burgess Hill, who've just won the most extraordinary promotion from Sussex Division 3 East, but we'll not go there now. The other local club, which is literally two streets away, is St Andrews, and finally they seem to be getting round to the idea that it might be a good idea to pool resources. But there we are. If you were listening outside, Nigel, you have heard me ask the two questions that we're asking absolutely everybody this season. Let's go first. Women's section at Godalming?
Absolutely. Probably one of the most successful teams at Godalming in the sense of its growth. We have 25 ladies who play. They are in a league, Surrey Trust League, which I believe becomes the women Surrey Women's League next year. They have attracted 6 or 7 new players this year. There is even more talk and within the Surrey area of more and more players joining that. It's extremely well run from a side that really only started 5-6 years ago, started by Dawn Jukes, who took up the baton and handed it over to Nikki Wall, who has taken it to the next level. It really is what I call a rounded club. I think you have to have that section and tick that box. The women's game is by far the most growing element of cricket.
I sat on Bank Holiday Monday, riveted, quite honestly, when Surrey came up on the rails and struggling, and then Natsiver got her 70-odd, and they saw off Heather Knight's lot, and then they just rolled Loughborough out of sight in the final. I mean, Lizelle Lee hits it like a man. Of that there is no doubt. And funnily enough, Tim, after the conversation we had last time about the Surrey Stars and the South African influence at the Oval, and we must mention Morny Morkel's 50 wickets later on when we talk about Surrey winning the championship today, the paper led the second time. There was a photograph of Danny van Niekerk and Marizanne Kapp and the trophy, and the headline was Wedded Bliss. So there it was. Yeah. But it was Ebony, I think, who said Lizelle Lee hits it further than I've ever seen a woman hit it.
And, 104, didn't she?
104 in that final. It just took it away. Yeah. And the Loughborough Lightning just crumbled. So a little higher up the echelons than the village cricket we were talking about last half hour. Nigel, has the new law book impinged on cricket at Godalming in any way?
In particular?
Well, I'm just thinking, you know, we do have a new law book. Players seem comfortably oblivious. Panel umpires more or less understand it. I just wonder if there's been any sense that the new laws had impinged on your matches in any way.
No. Any new laws, and I'm not aware of any significant new laws in the sense that I've captained the side along with my fellow First 11 captain, has never impinged on any game we've played. I think as a club, we have always gone out to play cricket in a manner that should be played with respect, and we have never over the years ever had any issues with that on a playing field.
Yeah, I think a lot of the new laws were to do with discipline and sort of that sort of stuff. I mean, David and I sat through a seminar in February where probably for both of us, and I think for a lot of the umpires that were there, some of the laws on time penalties and all this stuff were quite complicated, let's put it that
arcane
way. Yeah, and a lot of the people that were guests we've had in your seat over the season, same as you, it's not really impinged because I think most people just carried on as they were before. So, you know, it's amazing really how important the cricket authorities thought the new laws were, but they seem to have been generally ignored. But
yeah, I think a lot of that comes from television and seeing how it's played at a higher level. But it's up to the clubs to dictate.
Do you have separate umpires for that?
We have a club umpire,
right?
Who does First 11 cricket?
Okay.
Occasionally, we have a second 11 umpire, but like every other club, that requires getting 12 members of the club.
So generally, it's
players.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Okay. And you did you say you had a Sunday team as well?
We do have a Sunday team, more of a gentleman team, as we call it. But that's played on a Sunday.
That's friendly.
It's 35. Yeah, there's no league cricket on a Sunday,
no.
Apart from the ladies who play their league cricket on a Sunday.
Sure.
So that's a great resource to have a regular first team umpire, panel umpire appointed. Neither here nor there.
It makes
got somebody
difference.
Doing it.
It makes such a difference.
Absolutely. We've got probably under 2 minutes, but let's just talk amongst ourselves very briefly. Somebody from the west of the county, what about Surrey today?
They've won.
finally. Yes.
Absolutely unbelievable performance. I mean, some of the captain led from the front today.
Yeah, well, let's just hope that finally, I mean, we bang this drum, I think, every single month.
On this show for 2 years at least.
If he's not selected for the tour, he might as well retire.
Well, yes, please don't retire. Let's hope you are selected. One thing on that subject, if it were not for people like Fletcher, Duncan Fletcher in the old days, Marcus Truscovic would not have played Test cricket.
Correct.
Michael Vaughan would not have played Test cricket. It takes someone to see something in someone. I think we rely far too heavily on statistical information to say that produces a Test cricketer.
Oh, yeah.
That cannot be true.
No.
If that was the case, the world of cricket would have lost Viv Richards. No one's taught to hit across the line. We would have lost a number of players. Would Geoff Thompson have got past the Bowling Academy? We
Good
have
point.
To be
yep.
careful
yep.
how we select, and if purely on volume of runs scored and the manner he scored them, he has to be a pick.
Let's hope so. Anyway, a tremendous performance. Let's not sell Morne Morkel short, international bowler who's come in and shown up.
Can we take him to Sri Lanka?
It would be nice, wouldn't it? Wouldn't that be nice? But, well, that's what we haven't got, isn't it? With Mark Wood, Mark Wood's going to be another Simon Jones, I think with injuries and all the rest of it. And they talk about these two young men, Overton, so the other Overton at Somerset, and this boy, Oliver Stone, isn't it? They reckon's a bit slippery, but I would imagine, unless you've got express pace through the air, you're wasting your time flogging away in Sri Lankan wickets, aren't you?
Yeah. I mean, most teams, and from what I've heard, unlike the old days where it would spin after a certain period of time, the wickets turn from ball one. Now, I've never played there, that's up to the experts to decide. But if it spins from ball one, I think someone like Jimmy Anderson and Stuart Broad will have a very, very light workload.
You will come and see us again, won't you, Nigel?
I'm invited.
Oh, you bet. We could talk. It's a long way for you to come schlepping over from Godalming, but it's been brilliant to have you here. Nigel Churiman from Godalming Cricket Club, delight to have you on the front foot, and we'll look forward to next time.
Thank you. Susie Radio.
Welcome back to the final half hour of On the Front Foot for this month of September. We've changed guests in the hot seat yet again. Adith Arp, Mogador Wanderers, good evening. It's lovely to see you.
Good evening, David. It's lovely to be here.
It's nice to have someone in that seat with whom I go back almost to time immemorial.
Well, it's been a while, hasn't it? Yeah.
Now, before we talk about Mogador Wanderers, I must just tell you that Simon Highgate, who you both know, was driving through the area this afternoon from site to site. He's based in Bristol, but he was listening to my music show on the magic thing in the car, and he sent me a text afterwards and asked to be remembered to you both.
Well, that's very nice, yeah.
I haven't seen Simon for years. For a long time.
Nor have I. He was a class batsman.
Still holds the record, doesn't he, at Reigate Grammar School?
221 against Emmanuel on that astonishing day. That's perhaps for another time. Now, Andy, we've had Godalming in the last half hour, so we've had a little bit of league cricket still, but this evening it's really been about friendly cricket and now wandering cricket. And it says here that Alex Hewitt became captain in 1999, but after 18 years he stood down last year, and Adith Arp moved up from a stalwart spell as vice captain and holder of other offices. Let's wind you up and let you go.
Well, I took over from Alex 2 years ago. Alex was and is still a vital member of our team. He scored 200s, and he was committed to the Mogs 100%. But he's moved down to Headley in Hampshire, so it became very difficult for him to maintain. So as vice captain, I took the chalice on and said, "Yeah, I will become captain of what I believe is probably one of the best clubs in Surrey, if not the country." The ethos of the Mogador Wanderers is something that I hold very dear. We are a wandering team, as the name suggests. We play friendly cricket, we play sociable cricket, and we play cricket to enjoy it. And I think that's what it's all about.
Tell us a little bit, insofar as you and I go back part of the way, about 70 years of history.
It was formed in 1949, the club, so as you say, it's our 70th anniversary this year. It's quite an amusing story. The club was actually formed at on the idea of three of the girlfriends of the founding members who, I believe, were getting a bit sick and tired of their boyfriends being around on a Saturday and Sunday, and said, "Why don't you do something interesting? Why don't you form a cricket club?" And they said, "Oh, that's a good idea." So they decided to form a cricket club, and we are called the Mogador Wanderers because one of the founders, they said, "Well, let's call ourselves after the nearest telephone exchange." And there's a telephone exchange up at Mogador, so that's how the club was formed in 1949. And initially, we play Saturdays and Sundays. We even had a Colts team in the early 50s, where our current chairman and president David Martin played, and Peter Martin, infamous Peter Martin the Major, was a key member of that.
Let me stop you there, Andy. Let's talk about David and the late Peter Martin.
They say they're stalwarts of the club. David was a phenomenal batsman. Hit the ball very, very hard. Whereas Major was a resolute batsman at best. Very interesting technique when he was batting, but I think he's more famous for his bowling and the grenades that he used to throw up in the air. A very stuttering run-up, and lobbed the ball 20 metres in the air. Sorry, not 20 metres, 20 feet in the air.
I tell you what, it felt like 20 metres at times.
Tim and I batted against him many a times when I played at Merstham, and I used to really not look forward to facing the Major.
We were talking earlier on, when I used to play for Charwood, Mogador Wanderers used to play Mogador every single year, and I remember batting against Peter, and as you say, when he come on, you think, here we go.
Because you didn't know whether to play forward or back. I mean, he took 262...
I was gonna say, he must have taken a lot of wickets.
262 wickets for the Mogador Wanderers. I can remember one game in Menorca, keeping wickets, and it was an artificial wicket, and he kept on throwing the ball up, and the ball was bouncing so high that the guy was basically turning around and hitting it over my head. So I ended up sprinting back and taking a catch that way. But
As a not especially talented left-handed opening batsman, I used to hate it when they threw grenades.
Yeah.
I only ever got after it once. We played on tour at Western Supermare on the background, not the front one, and I took my courage in both hands and just got down the wicket for once in my life and hit it straight, and it was easy after that.
But
I
it's amazing, isn't it amazing, I think, in sort of village cricket, the amount of let's call them senior players, that bowl that type of
ball. Oh, yeah.
And they take wicket after wicket after wicket, and they fox people every single week, and the amount of people that fall for it, it's just incredible.
It is, and as I say, that's the beauty of playing friendly cricket and playing on Sundays as well. In our team currently, we have Peter Ferner, who is... And he'll hate me for saying this on air, but he's probably 74, almost 75. Mm-hmm. All the way through to Oscar and Alfie and Harry, who are 13, 14.
Mm. Yeah.
So you get the full age spectrum, and you get, within that, a various range of bowling techniques.
And the fact that you've had this generational thing, this family connection through generations, seems to me the only possible lifeblood of a wandering side for such a long period. I mean, we were a bit different at Cats because it was specifically a bunch of friends, and when domestic things came calling and so on, in the end it folded up. But Jim Grant's lot, the men, Jim's a regular pundit on the show, Jim Grant's lot have survived into the next generation. It's interesting, is David Martin still playing?
No, David retired, I'm trying to think now, probably about 7-8 years ago.
Okay, because he must be in his 70s.
Yes. Yeah. He did come out of retirement for one game on tour in Exmouth. As he was recounted to me last week, never again.
I regret it in some ways, but to me it's always been about mobility in the field. I'm sure I could pick a bat up and go out and make a few runs, but I'd struggle to run quick singles. And immobile in the field is not fair to
No, it's not. And I think that's what David realised when he said that he was just too old for the field. And I think that's what amazes me about Peter Ferner at 74. That he's still sprinting around, running around. I mean, he does wear shin pads now, but it's phenomenal.
I wouldn't have had Peter Ferner down as being that much older than Keith Briggs. I really wouldn't.
No,
extraordinary.
It is.
We've touched upon AJ and Tim. Forgive us for talking about mutual acquaintances here, but particularly since I've known the Briggses so well the last 20 years or so, I've watched quite a bit of Moggs cricket on and off. My old friend, who I was at school with and helped me with Cats Colts, Richard Moss.
Yes.
Played, didn't he?
Yes, he did.
He's retired now, isn't
he? Yes, he has, yes. Unfortunately, I've sort of lost contact with Richard, he was Super Mario, as we called him. He was, a very good cricketer and loved the Moggs.
Yeah, not that much younger than me, Richard, I suppose. While we've got plenty of time, Andy, let's talk about Matt Lewis.
Yeah, Matt. Matt was my best friend. He was he and I grew up together. My dad and my mum and Alan and Pat. My dad and Alan played cricket together down the road at Merstham.
Yeah.
So we were every Saturday down at the Merstham Cricket Club, from midday through to about 7-8 o'clock in the evening. So I grew up with Matthew, and we went to Australia together. And he and I played at Merstham in the senior sides, and then through AJ, Alex joined the Mogdor Wanderers. He managed to entice Matthew to come and play at the Moggs.
Yeah.
He had a stellar career at the Moggs. And then when I stopped being captain at Merstham, I thought it was then only then suitable for me to join the Moggs. So I joined the Moggs in the late 90s, and we played together every Sunday. And it was a real shame and heartbreaking that it's 7 years ago now.
Is it as long ago as that?
Yeah, 7 years ago, just before Christmas. Yeah, he passed away from a heart attack.
Yeah. Was he 40, 41 or 2?
42.
Yeah, absolutely. Be a slow left arm bowler, Tim, and a very talented one. You both played for me in one of those Hartswood occasional
games. We did, yes.
At Hawley.
Yeah.
That I used to do.
I seem to remember we got 50 that day as well.
Yeah, they had a... we played against Hawley, and they also had a brewery side come down.
Yes.
And I put a team out against them sometimes. It was all great fun, yes. So Oscar is now playing.
Oscar's played... Oscar is... he's going to be a phenomenal cricketer.
Oh, that's good.
Someone to really look out for the future. He plays for Sussex. He's at Hurstpier Point. He plays for Hurstpier Point.
All right.
Under 15s,
right.
I think. He's a keeper. He's a excellent batsman. And he's also bowls really mean spin as well, off spin.
I'll have to get the inside story off Nick Creed at Hurst next time I see him.
Do,
because... Have a word.
Because he is... And obviously there's a... a lot of emotion there in terms of you want him to be really good. But I mean, I'll be the first to talk to him and say, look, actually, Oscar, come on, knuckle down. But he, every time he's played for us, he has done us so proud.
And of course, I go back to finishing nets at the grammar school at 6 o'clock on a Friday, and Matt and AJ running the bar at the Fox Revive, the Plums over the road. You know, many glasses of Rioja later.
Yes. I mean, the pubs seem to have an integral part of the Mogador Wanderers. I mean, how we choose our fixtures is, when I was fixture secretary, I had three sort of major criteria. One was there a very good pub nearby, so we could have an ale before and an ale afterwards if there wasn't a bar at the club. Is the ground picturesque and beautiful? And two, what's the standard of the tea? And they were the three criteria, and that's how we used to select our fixtures.
And that's precisely why, when my old pal Mike Trowbridge moved down to Burgess Hill, Katz started heading for Sussex as soon as he'd got his feet under the table on precisely those criteria. I mean, we quite often used to have Sunday lunch together in the pub before
We do. You know? Yeah. We have on teas, we have what we call now is the Ditchling scale, because we play Ditchling every year. Now, Ditchling, a wonderful little village club, just the bottom of the Beacon, and their teas are phenomenal. I mean, there are four or five clubs that we play that do phenomenal teas, but Ditchling used to have homemade cakes, and they literally three or four tiers high, scones with big clot of cream, and everyone was like, oh my goodness. And there was champagne at the tea this year.
I only came there once to watch you, quite coincidental on Toby's sister Hannah being home from Red Sea or whatever. But I came because I didn't know that Ditchling existed. I've always played at and against St James's over the other side of the crossroads, you see.
That's a nice ground, the St James's one, but
There's another instance of a small village, Burgess Hill's a town, I suppose, but Godalming, Farncombe again, supporting two full tilt sides. Tim, I need to let you get a word in edgeways and get the subject back to the Mogs.
Well, I was interested, I was reading your website earlier on. You sent me the link to the website, and I can understand why you didn't want to try and sort of transpose that onto an email when I started reading through the detail on the history. And one thing that I was quite interested in was it talked about the sort of infamous tours that that you've been on. And I know there's the saying, what goes on tour stays on tour. So I'm not asking for any sort of scandal, but just give us a sort of flavour of what sort of the sort of atmosphere on a Mogs tour.
Oh, I mean, the phenomenal is the best way I can describe it. I mean, I've been fortunate enough to tour Perranporth in Cornwall. I've been fortunate enough to go to Menorca twice with the Mogs. We've been down to Lechlade, and we currently tour in Gloucestershire. A place called Dumbleton, which again is a stunning ground. A Mogs tour to all intents and purposes. I mean, we do have other halves and family members come along, but normally it's just a men only tour, and it's just basically a bunch of friends getting together, playing the game they love, having a few drinks, and they're just great. I mean,
what is it? Is it usually a week? Is it?
No. Well, I think when we went to Menorca, they were 5 days, and we would play three games against Menorca. When we've been down to Lechlade or to Gloucester, currently we play two/three games, mainly two games, might have a round of golf in between. The last tour we've just been on, we were due to play Cirencester on the Sunday, and it got rained off, and we played Dumbleton on the Monday.
Right.
And then back on the Tuesday. So it's only a three-day tour. It's a mini tour, but...
And you presumably don't struggle for people to come along on the tours?
You'd be surprised. I mean, I think, like any club nowadays, I think when you're asking people to take time off work, it becomes tricky. We are fortunate that we have probably in the region of about 30 to 35 playing members that we can call on. The struggle that we have, and it's raising its head again for this Sunday's game, we've got nine confirmed. I need to find two players. Yeah. It's Thursday evening.
Mm. And it's the same old problem, isn't it?
It is, but that's part and parcel of the type of club we are, because we only have one team. Mm. So we have players that will play four, five, six games. We have, like myself and a couple of us, like Will Parker, Huge, and a few others that will play the 23 games that we have on our fixture list. So it's just a balancing act, trying to get it all sorted.
If you don't mind, Andy, I don't think I'll shake the moths out of my cricket bag, even if you are too.
Well, you know, well, maybe if Tim wants a game on Sunday. Well, it's East Horsley, so it's just, you know,
on the estate. Absolutely. I've been to Dumbleton. I can't remember who I went there to watch. I don't think it was you, but I've certainly been to Dumbleton. A village without a pub, as I recall.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah. But so the clubhouse, I mean, Dumbleton, I mean, the president at Dumbleton is a treasure. He really is. He plays a guitar, and they are probably one of the most hospitable clubs I've ever been to. We play them. It's an all-day game. Obviously, lunch is a village affair, so they have a huge marquee, and it's not just a case of the 22 players and umpires sitting down to have lunch. All the village. Yep. And they invite their friends, and then tea is the same. Then they'll cook us dinner in the evening, and then we stay in the bar till 3-4 in the morning, singing songs with the. And it's honestly, it's phenomenal. It really is. It
can still be done. I was fascinated that at Lye, where they've got this tradition of wonderful all-day cricket, which Burley and Holman picked up from the all-day games they played at school, without any, well, we can do that, you know, and they did. I'm interested that it's that the levers are turning against, the pendulum swinging against.
Yeah,
you know?
it's odd, isn't it?
But there we are. Time marches on, gentlemen. So before we march on with it, Andy, anything else you'd like to tell us about the Mogs as things stand?
Oh, well, I'm everyone who's listening, I think, you know, the Mogs, we are, you know, it's our 70th year, we've been going, you know, as I say, since 1949. We hope one of the friendliest teams that you'll ever meet, play against. We have a full fixture list of 23 fixtures, but we're always on the lookout for more. Again, if there is anyone out there that thinks, actually, I'd like to play Sunday cricket now instead of the pressures of league cricket, then we are more than happy to welcome you to our club. We're having our 70th anniversary at Kempton Park, so we're going horse racing in October, so that should be a good event. And I think, you know, If anyone's interested, just get in contact with myself or any other person from the website. You can do it via the website.
And the website is?
www.nwcc.co.uk.
Just MWCC. That's tremendous. Folks, you can also always email david.jay@suzyradio.com. Andy, we're going to have to leave the Mogs there, I think, because I just want to broaden things out for the final 5 minutes or so of the show. Surrey have won the county championship today.
Brilliant.
What we didn't say earlier is that it looks as if Sussex have blown it with two games to go, because Kent won this last game and Sussex didn't, and the gap is now 21 points, which is a lot to make up over two games. So maybe south of the county border are not so good, and we're all crossing our fingers, aren't we, Tim, for Rory Burns?
Well, yeah, I mean, we said it earlier on, and maybe we sound a bit like a stuck record, that we always bang the drum for Rory Burns to be included. He had another great performance in the match against Worcester. I think he got a ton in the first innings, 66 in the second innings. You know, I don't understand why he's not featured at all in the England team this summer. As we said earlier on, if he doesn't get picked for this up-and-coming tour, it will be disastrous, I think. He's been such a great player. I know his technique's a bit odd, and maybe he doesn't look the sort of classic player, but what a player he is.
Like you say, Tim, his technique might be a bit odd, but look at Graham Smith.
Yeah, well, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I think you're somebody who scored 1,000 runs in the Championship, 5 seasons in a row, how he can be overlooked if you look at the people that have had that opening berth for the last 4 or 5 years, the likes of Lyth, you know, I know Stoneman had it for a while.
Yeah.
You know, Jennings has got it now. I mean, I would be shocked.
Well, especially now Cook's retired.
Yeah. Speaking of whom, you wouldn't point an 11-year-old at Alistair Cook and say bat like him in terms of technique, would you?
No, you wouldn't.
Let's very quickly talk about Cook and Anderson. What an absolute fairy tale. Both of them apparently texted Cook and said, can I have my scriptwriter back?
Yeah, I mean, you couldn't have scripted it any better, could you? I mean, I think, I think Cook's 70 in the first innings was a monumental innings. For him to then come out and score 100 in the second innings, when we need, you know, obviously we needed those runs importantly, you couldn't have scripted that any better. And then for Jimmy Anderson to break McGrath's record, and
you know, I was watching it and I was looking at Joe Root at the TV and I was shouting at the TV saying, why don't you just give him the new ball? Mm. I mean, like, you could see Rashid was turning it, but look, just give him the new ball, please.
Yeah.
We could talk about all this for another hour, clearly, but Henry Mack is waiting in the wings. Very briefly, I think the thing to me about Anderson this last couple of years is the way he got his 500th by knocking the lot over, and he knocked the middle pole out to get his 564.
Yeah, well, I mean, they talked about, wouldn't it have been good if he'd nicked it to Cook.
That would have been,
But let's be honest, as a fast bowler, to break a record cartwheeling a middle stump out of the ground, that's how you
do it. And, you know, you've got to pay credit to his, you know, tenacity. I mean, I think what he's been through throughout his career, you know, to be taking 564-65 wickets. And
well, even to stay fit for the test that he's
Exactly.
It's an amazing achievement, you know. So
we talked about the Major earlier at the Moggs. The Brigadier's retired today. Paul Collingwood's announced his retirement.
Yes.
To me, a real product of his environment, a real gritty, gutsy cricketer, the only England captain ever to have won an international tournament. For me, I'm not sure that Sky ought to necessarily replay it as often as they do, but tainted forever by that match at the Oval in 2008 when Ryan Sidebottom barged Grant, I can't think of his other name, barged the New Zealand batsman over and Collingwood wouldn't call him back. I thought that was really very, very highly unfortunate.
Shame of that. But both of them called him. He said he was one of the greatest all-rounders to ever grace the game of cricket.
Well, I'm not so sure about that.
Well, I suppose it's a Durham bias.
He's a good all-rounder.
That's the Durham chairman talking, isn't it? So yes, there we are. And I don't know whether two gentlemen of your close vintage. Let me just say, Tim, that Andy Tharp, sitting next to you, caught one of the two finest catches in 25 years I ran the side at Reigate. We're at Brighton College. Andy's at short extra cover. The guy leathered it off the back foot into the covers, and Andy's gone full length and caught it down about a foot off the ground. And the only other catch to match that was from the same bunch of young lads.
Justin Jackson
caught a slip catch against Rutledge at Hartswood, which he caught. You know the one that Stokes caught behind him in the gully? It was like that. Absolutely. Cook caught one in this series. Absolutely extraordinary. And I'm sitting here slightly embarrassed because, you know, Tim, you didn't manage at all. Andy played a handful of first team games in an era when we were so flushed for cricketers and teachers that in 1990 we put out three full school 11s and three staff 11s on the same day, and they all played one another. It's all changed out of all recognition.
It's sad.
Just a little bit of news to say that East Grinstead won the Grey Nichols T20 Sussex Cup. They beat holders and premiership champions Roffey in a final with last ball drama. East Grinstead 144-6 beat Roffey 144-8 by virtue of losing fewer wickets. And Roffey have a last tilt at glory in the final of the Vitality National Club T20 this coming Sunday. They've carried all before them, Roffey. They are the outward of Sussex. So that was tremendous news. And I mentioned our vintage, and let's come back round that circle. Is either of you really bothered that Worcestershire are playing Lancashire and Sussex are playing Somerset in the T20 Blast finals on Saturday?
It's you know, I think T20 has its place. I think, you know, that those four counts, and I think Worcestershire, definitely it's first time there. They'll enjoy it. I think the crowds enjoy it. I mean, it's not necessarily. I mean, I don't think I would be a very good T20 cricketer.
might be a good fielder.
Well, I might be, but I mean, I think it has its place. But I think what the Test series this year, this summer has just proven is that.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I think Kohli, and again, without wanting to talk on too long, Kohli I thought was phenomenal in his after match speech, and the way he was so gracious to Alistair Cook, but how he was saying, look, Test cricket is alive and well, and it's, you know, they all love playing it.
I've said it before to you, David. I have really no interest in the T20 Blast. I have to say it just does not interest me at all. Really. I mean, it's a great day out, great evening out, but
Virat Kohli, tremendous cricketer, not the world's best Test captain, and I don't think Joe Root's very far behind him on that scale, quite honestly. But there we are. Such is life. It's been great fun having you here, Andy, and we've hardly scratched the surface. You'd be more than welcome to come in any month to be a pundit rather than a representative of the Moggs. Because, you know, we three, we've got a lot in common and lots of stories to tell, which we haven't got round to tonight. So, Andy Tharp, representative tonight of Mogadore Wanderers, thanks ever so much, and do come and see us again.
David, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Tim, good night.
Good night, David.
And there we are. Many, many thanks to Kanna Shanmugam and Nigel from Godalming in the last half hour, and my very good, very old friend Andy Tharp. That's old in terms of the distance we go back, not in terms of years. I've got a few of those on him. As I said earlier, we're going to be back in a month's time, not on the first Thursday of October, because there are clashing commitments. So we'll be here on Thursday the 11th, and our intentions are to have a proper roundup of the local clubs' successes in the league, to present Outward with their certificate, and then start looking ahead to a Sri Lanka tour, which will actually be underway by then, but looking ahead to the Test series.